From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. As Arctic winds whip the Northeast, the Giants of January will gird on the gridiron to fight frigid foes and dream steamy Super Bowl dreams. Ahead on Only a Game, football's Fab Four fight for a Houston visit. Also a conversation with Pete Dexter, author of Train, and Facing the Music with Double Dutch Jump Ropers. Also ahead, the hockey gender gap at the University of Minnesota Duluth.
One of our Bulldogs put a good hit on the Huskies, and the women can't do that. See, that would have been a penalty in women's hockey. That's why the people are here and not at the women's game.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Three American soldiers and two Iraqi security workers were killed after a roadside bomb exploded north of Baghdad today. A U.S. military official said with the 4th Infantry Division says two other U.S. soldiers were injured in that attack. All seven were riding in a Bradley fighting vehicle when it hit the bomb on a road about 20 miles north of Baghdad. The vehicle flipped over and caught fire. The Bush administration says it may make changes to its plans to restore Iraqi sovereignty, but won't delay the transfer of power deadline of June 30th. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The U.S. Administrator of Iraq, Paul Bremer, says he's sticking to the June 30th target date for a handover of power. He's faced stiff criticism for his plan to hold regional caucuses to choose a national assembly by then. A leading Shiite cleric has demanded direct elections instead. Speaking outside the White House, Bremer said neither he nor the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan believe elections are possible.
We have doubts, as does the Secretary General, that elections can in fact be called in the time frame of the return of sovereignty to the Iraqi people on June 30th. But these are questions that obviously need to be looked at.
U.S. officials say when Bremer meets Annan on Monday, he'll ask the U.N. to send a fact-finding mission to Iraq to persuade the Shiites that there's not enough time for elections and to help come up with a compromise. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Another herd of cows in eastern Washington state has been quarantined as a precaution in the mad cow disease investigation. From member station KPLU, Paige Hansen has details.
State agriculture officials placed a hold on a herd of cows at Connell in southeastern Washington. USDA investigators say five animals in the herd came from the same herd in Canada as the Holstein at another Washington dairy in Mabton that had mad cow disease. The U.S. Agriculture Department reported the first test results on animals killed this week from the Mabton herd. The 28 samples that have been reviewed so far have proven negative. In all, 129 cows from the Mabton dairy are being killed. Last week, 449 calves were killed, including one calf from the diseased cow. For NPR News, I'm Paige Hansen in Tacoma.
President Bush appointed Judge Charles Pickering to the Fifth Circuit Federal Appeals Court after a two-year battle with Congress. Senate Democrats filibustered Pickering's nomination over his civil rights record. Democrats accused him of supporting segregation as a young man. Senator Patrick Leahy says installing Pickering to the federal bench was a mistake.
The glory of our federal court system in this country is that it's always been independent of either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And this is the first president who has really tried to make it a political court. That's wrong. People should reject it.
The appointment can't be reversed until 2005. This is NPR. As Congress considers rewriting the Endangered Species Act, Europe is grappling with its own loss of wildlife. The European Union's environment chief called for urgent action Friday to save hundreds of species of birds, animals, and plants from extinction. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Congress, business leaders, homeowners, and environmentalists have been battling for decades over the Endangered Species Act in the United States, which turned 30 this year. While many say it's time for an overhaul, other nations are just beginning to confront the problem of dwindling populations. EU Environment Commissioner Margot Wallström will tell European leaders next week at a conference in Madrid that the ecosystem is threatened. EU leaders have pledged to stop the loss of wildlife by 2010. Wallstrom says that won't happen without radical change to urban sprawl, agriculture practices, and transportation systems. Meanwhile, here in the United States, the chairman of the House Resources Committee, Richard Pombo, aims to change the Endangered Species Act because he says it produces more lawsuits and property disputes than it provides protection for wildlife. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News.
Democrats are pulling out all the stops this weekend in hopes of last-minute campaigning will pay off before Monday night's Iowa caucuses. The race is seen as too close to call. Most of the Democratic presidential hopefuls are crisscrossing the state, hoping to win over undecided voters whose numbers remain high in Iowa. President Bush is putting the final touches on his State of the Union speech. He addresses a joint session of Congress Tuesday night. Aides say he's going over his speech while spending the weekend at Camp David. Press Secretary Scott McClellan says the speech will take stock of the administration's accomplishments. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow in the National Football League's conference championship games, the New England Patriots will try to avoid being trampled by the Indianapolis Colts at 3 o'clock in Foxborough, Massachusetts, and the Carolina Panthers will stalk the Eagles in Philadelphia at 6:45. Fans of the Eagles, the team that has appeared in both of the past two NFC championship games and lost both of them, have been more passionate and demonstrative than most fans elsewhere. They've also been angrier, more abusive, and more disappointed, although this year, perhaps because their team is playing in a new stadium, or perhaps because it's once again one win shy of the Super Bowl, Eagles fans have been better behaved than in previous seasons, and one perhaps representative Philadelphian rooter is also more optimistic than usual.
Most indubitably, yes,
yeah.
Most indubitably.
Yeah.
I mean, once they get past Carolina, which is going to be a cinch, the only obstacle is going to be between the Patriots or the Colts. You know, everybody believes in miracles. I know I do.
Another Eagles fan, Joe Queen, and the author of True Believers, joins me now to discuss his team's prospects and related matters. Joe, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here.
Are Eagles fans generally optimistic at this point, or is optimism in an Eagle fan's repertoire?
Yeah, I think they're optimistic about they've already beaten the Panthers on the road. I think that the two teams that the Eagles most feared were the Packers, definitely, because of Favre. People were afraid of the Rams until they lost the final game against the Lions. Also, the Rams play indoors, and they'd have a very hard time winning in Philadelphia in what's going to be. It's going to be cold. It's not going to be as cold as it's been. It's been in the, 7 degrees the past few days. I think by game time, it'll probably be, 22. By the end of that game, it's going to be brutal, though. But it's not going to be as bad as it's been the past few days.
Joe, in the bad old days of Veterans Stadium, Eagles fans who misbehaved were sometimes seized, tried, and incarcerated on the premises while the game was still in progress. But has winning changed everything?
Well, that story's not entirely true. The first year that the hanging judge had his court there, but after that they were taken to a nearby police station. You know, people would come in and get their photograph taken. You know, I survived the hanging judge. And when I talked to him, we both agreed that the problem here was that you could only find these guys. If you put them in a Philadelphia jail overnight, if you put them in a Philadelphia jail for 20 minutes, that kind of antisocial behavior would be cured because Philadelphia is a rough town.
Well, if the stories about guys being seized, tried, and incarcerated on the premises are, in most cases, apocryphal, can you give me an event that accurately characterizes the bad old days of Eagles fans?
You know, there was always the things about throwing the snowballs at Santa Claus and, Jimmy Johnson was pelted with ice balls when he was leaving the stadium. And a few years ago, Michael Irvin, his career ended on a hit in Philadelphia, and people were cheering. And I actually met Michael Irvin on the Best Damn Sports Show last summer, and he was asking why people were doing that. And I told him it was just because people in Philadelphia respected him so much that they not only wanted to see him out of the game, they wanted to see him out of the sport.
If the Eagles make it to the Super Bowl, will vast numbers of Philadelphians be driving RVs or riding airplanes down to Houston?
No, I think that most people will watch it with their friends or watch it in bars. I was in Philly in 93 with my daughter. I was at the game when the Phillies won the National League pennant against the Braves. And being in the city that night and hearing the klaxoning and partying with people in the streets till 5 in the morning was one of the happiest experiences of my life. So if the Eagles are in the Super Bowl, I want to be in Philadelphia. And I think most people feel that way. The Super Bowl is largely attended by, you know, sort of corporate people who don't really root for one team or the other. I think that most of the hardcore fans are going to watch this in a bar.
It sounds to me as if you're saying Philadelphia fans would just be thrilled if the Eagles were to win the Super Bowl. They wouldn't be worried about giving up their kind of image of following a team that has so often been unsuccessful?
No, the city's desperate for a winner. And part of the thing is that the 76ers have won a couple of times. The Phillies have finally won in 1980, and they've won three pennants. The Flyers have won a Stanley Cup, and the Flyers always contend. But football, for all intents and purposes, is the national sport, and it's the sport that you want to see your team win in. My son and I have often talked about the fact that we wish football was played 52 weeks a year. I mean, I wouldn't care if they never had a champion just so that they played it, because one of the bittersweet things about this weekend is last weekend you had four games, and you had four classic football games. This week you've got two, and next week you've got one, and after that you've got regular season hockey, and you've got regular season basketball. And basketball, since Michael Jordan has retired, has gone back to being a second-tier sport, and hockey is an eighth-tier sport.
All right. You're a longtime fan of Philadelphia teams in general and the Eagles in particular. Give me either your dream of the way this weekend's game in Philadelphia goes or your nightmare of the way it might go, whichever you like.
Okay. The nightmare is that the Eagles are too pumped up from beating the Packers and don't show up for the game the way they didn't show up last year for the game against Tampa Bay. I don't think that's going to happen, though, because Donovan McNabb wasn't ready to play last year. He is ready to play now. The dream scenario is that if the Eagles get an early turnover and get a score early, they're going to be hard to beat. When you get inside the 20, it's very difficult to score against the Eagles. When you get inside the 5, it's impossible.
Joe Queenan is the author of True Believers. He's also a columnist for Smart Money and Men's Health. And, of course, he's a fan of the Philadelphia Phillies, Flyers, 76ers, and Eagles. Joe, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
In the year 2000, its first year of competition, the women's hockey team from the University of Minnesota Duluth slipped badly and did not win the national championship. It has since won every available title. The Bulldogs are currently ranked fourth in the nation as they fight for their fourth consecutive NCAA championship, but you wouldn't know it by the size of the crowds at their home games. Minnesota Public Radio's Stephanie Hemphill reports.
At this year's first University of Minnesota Duluth home game, the women lined up on the ice to watch as their latest NCAA championship banner rose to the rafters. But the fans filled only a few rows close to the ice. There were 413 people at the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Center, a hockey facility that seats 5,300. The team finds little consolation in the fact that it ranks second in attendance nationwide.
My sister's number 23 on the Bulldogs, so I come to all the games that I can.
Joshua Stotts is brother of Bulldogs junior forward Megan Stotts. He says a lot of fans think the women's game isn't intense or physical enough, but he disagrees.
Hockey's not all about checking and fighting and stuff like that. It's more about finesse and your fundamentals, and obviously the girls have great fundamentals and they're a great hockey team, so I think more people should come out and watch them.
The size of the crowd makes a difference to the players, according to Jenny Hempel, who played for the Bulldogs last year and recruits for the team now.
having people out here cheer for you, you know, it's a really good feeling. It gets you excited, makes you just ready for the game and everything, and there definitely needs to be more people here for these games.
A couple of weeks later, it was a very different scene as the UMD men's team played St. Cloud State, one of its biggest rivals. This time, there were over 5,000 fans cheering on the Bulldogs. The Minnesota Duluth men have been local favorites for 60 years, though they haven't been to the national tournament in a decade. But their poor showing in recent years doesn't stop female fans from attending games.
I mainly go with my friends, and not many of them go to the women's games.
Why do you think that is?
Maybe because the crowds aren't as big, and it doesn't get as enthusiastic.
It's more fun to watch them get in fights and stuff like that, and it seems elementary, but it's probably what gets me to come.
30 years ago, Steve Traxel played for the Bulldogs. Now he has a daughter playing on a high school team in Duluth. He differentiates between the men's and women's games as he watches UMD play St. Cloud State.
This is an action game where the girls are for fun. One of our Bulldogs put a good hit on the Huskies. And the women can't do that. See, that would have been a penalty in women's hockey. That's why the people are here and not at the women's game.
But UMD head coach Shannon Miller disagrees. Miller led the Canadian national team for 7 years and has been UMD's head coach since the program started 4 years ago. She points out that many Duluthians grew up watching the men.
And just now I think people are getting more comfortable with women being physical and playing sports and sweating, and they're starting to accept women. We're only in our fifth year of existence, and we're ranked second in the country for attendance. And so we're actually relatively pleased with our attendance compared to nationwide. But having said that, we also have won 3 national championships, and we do have a good product on the ice, and I think people are missing out by not coming.
But the team has recently enjoyed increased attention from local media. All the games are carried on the radio, and this year, for the first time, a TV station will carry 2 women's games along with all of the men's games. Captain Carolyn Ouellette believes her team will attract more fans if it simply keeps doing what it's always done.
Hopefully we can keep winning, and we will get people talking with another and say that, hey, girls too can play hockey, and it's a good show, and you should go see them, because when they come, I think they come back.
For Only a Game, I'm Stephanie Hempel in Duluth.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. A study made public this week by the Georgia Institute of Technology and the University of California at Irvine indicates that the chemicals responsible for the so-called runner's high may be closely related to THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana.
Whoa, dude, no way.
Stop it. This is a serious story. The study also could provide glaucoma sufferers with an alternative to marijuana.
Oh, bogus.
Enough. This is serious. The study may be the first step in debunking the theory that runner's high is caused... Runner's high is caused by
awesome.
Brain chemicals called endorphins, which some scientists have always said is a myth.
Oh, man.
I feel so high, I even touch the sky above the falling rain.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL action, the Philadelphia Flyers defoliated the Toronto Maple Leafs by a score of 4-1. The Carolina Hurricanes edged the Atlanta Thrashers 4-3. The Penguins of Pittsburgh succumbed to the Minnesota Wild 4-2. The Phoenix Coyotes and Detroit Red Wings skated to a 3-3 tie. And the Columbus Blue Jackets grabbed a 3-2 overtime win from the Los Angeles Kings. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce prognosticates regarding tomorrow's NFL Arctic and Polar Bowls, not necessarily in that order, but first, the big news this year in the world of women's college basketball is, of course, that the University of Connecticut has lost twice. Geno Auriemma's alleged powerhouse, led by consensus number one player in the game, Diana Taurasi, fell most recently to Notre Dame on Tuesday night. Joining me by phone now to discuss the topsy-turvy nature of the women's game these days is Michelle Vopel, who covers women's basketball for the Kansas City Star and for ESPN.com. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks a lot.
On January 3rd, Duke knocked off UConn by a point, 68-67. That could have been regarded as a fluke, but Tuesday night, Notre Dame beat UConn by 15. Are Duke and Notre Dame that good, or has UConn slipped?
Well, Duke's very good. Coming into that game, a lot of people didn't expect them to have to rally from as far back as they did.
Mm-hmm.
Notre Dame is a really slow starting team this year, but that's not all that unusual. So I think what you're seeing really is two pretty good teams, and they were able to exploit some weaknesses from UConn. UConn last year, I think, had some similar weaknesses, but nobody was able to exploit them. You know, whether or not that's going to matter in March, which is the key for UConn. That's what we'll have to see.
In another intriguing upset this week, Iowa State beat the team that had been number two in the country, or number one, depending on which poll you prefer, Texas Tech. Bill Fennelly, the Iowa State coach, said it was, quote, one of the greatest games I've ever been part of. Post-game hyperbole, or was that an accurate analysis?
Now, you know, I think I understand exactly what he's talking about, because Iowa State last year, they had kind of a down season. They really struggled. This year, earlier in December, they lost to interstate rival Drake. They scored only 36 points, and I was worried about Bill waking up the next morning after that one. But he fought back. He's a great coach. He's a very good strategic coach. And they were at home in Iowa State, and Texas Tech has not had a whole lot of luck when they've visited Iowa State. They've been there four times since the Big 12 started, and they've lost three times.
The number three team in the country, Texas, lost to number 24, Baylor, by 14 points on Wednesday night. Are we seeing a pattern here?
Nobody's in the Big 12 is going to be surprised when Baylor beats anybody. Nationally, people might have said, oh, wow, Texas went down. I think a lot of Big 12 followers were thinking that Baylor might be able to do that. Big 12 being the conference I cover, you know, most closely here in Kansas City, it's really a tough conference up and down. Baylor beats Texas, and a lot of people are giving Texas votes for number one. The number 12, considered number 12 team in the conference, Texas A&M, was up by 16 points on Baylor just a few days before. Baylor rallied to win that game. So that sort of gives you an idea of how tough that conference is. And what I think it might be leading toward is the idea that across the country, every year, you're getting more and more parity, more and more talent spread out to other teams. And that's something I think is just good for the game.
It's a little ironic, it seems to me, that more women's college teams seem to be getting better and better, even as folks are wondering if the WNBA will ever draw bigger crowds and otherwise grow and flourish. Will better competition at the college level re-energize the WNBA? Is that league's hope?
You know, right now, the talent level of the WNBA, to me, doesn't seem to be any kind of an issue, because once you go from whatever, you know, 300 and some Division I teams to the 13 WNBA teams, there's enough talent in the WNBA. I don't have any question about that. It's sort of figuring out the difference between growing the grassroots game and everything with a college as opposed to running a business that's going to make money. And I think if you look at the history of pro sports, there's a pretty high failure rate. There's a pretty high transitory rate. You know, if you look at the history of the NFL, you know, it took a while for it to find the cities that it was going to work in. So maybe I'm maybe more optimistic about the WNBA than a lot of people. I do think it's going to eventually become a successful business, and I do think there's just a ton of talent already there, and that'll just keep getting better.
Let's return at the finish here to the discussion of these upsets. Does this make predicting what happens in March even harder than it normally is?
You know, I would say it probably does, but if you have looked at my bracket for the last 10 years, you could say I never knew what was going to happen anytime anyway. So, you know, I think it's been difficult. It'll keep being difficult, but, you know, that's what makes a game a blast to watch. You know, it's great. I think everybody's enjoyed these upsets, and I tell you, 6 or 9 is going to go down Sunday because Minnesota plays Purdue, and either Duke or Tennessee, who a lot of people in that right now say maybe, you know, Duke's number one, will Tennessee take it over? They got to play each other next Saturday on the 24th, so one of those teams is going to have a loss. It's cool. It's fun.
Michelle Vopel writes about women's basketball for the Kansas City Star and for ESPN.com. Michelle, I hope you see nothing but good games from here on in, and thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you. I hope it gets warmer.
Train, Pete Dexter's most recent novel, involves two sports, at least tangentially. The book is filled with golfers. The most gifted and accomplished among them is Lionel Walk, a caddy blessed with so much ability that he can teach himself to play brilliantly with a single club, the 9-iron that he finds one day in the rough. Lionel, nicknamed Train, is attached in various ways to Plural Lincoln, a damaged and dangerous ex-boxer whose nickname is No Tank, a reference to his inability to go more than 6 rounds. The presence of golfers and a former fighter in Train seems sufficient rationale for the first appearance on Only a Game of National Book Award winner Pete Dexter, who joins me now from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Mr. Dexter, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you.
Of Train, the young black golfer in the novel, it is said that it never occurred to him that anybody could play the game any better than he could. Have you ever run into anybody with that kind of self-assurance, either in the stories of your friend or in the courses you visited more recently?
What he's talking about there is his swing, mm-hmm. and it never occurred to him that anybody had that natural kind of a way of getting to the ball, of getting out of the way, and it goes. Mm-hmm. It just never occurred to him that anybody could do that better.
It must be a remarkable feeling.
Well, you're talking to the wrong guy.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, although under the
I'm
influence...
I'm talking of, as the wrong guy, too.
Yeah, under the influence of the drugs Dennis gave you for implants, I took one of those and walked out onto the course one day and had the feeling that I had a singular gift, but it wore off in about 4 hours.
On one of Train's few not-so-great days on the golf course, he feels his mistake is, quote, trying to make the ball go to the pin instead of letting it go. Is this sort of a zen of golf?
I don't know if it's a zen of golf. I think it's kind of the key to everything that, you know, people that have a very unique talent, it works best when you just let it work. If you try to guide it, most of the time, you're not smart enough to make it better than it is. I mean, the gift itself is the gift. It's about being natural. And if you layer that with lessons, or if you layer it with trying to be something beyond what that is, you know, if you're trying to refine it to sort of meld in with the common perceptions of what whatever that talent should be, is at that point you're diluting it instead of letting it go.
Train's companion throughout much of the novel is Plural Lincoln, the ex-boxer. He seems as if he could be based on any number of fighters, especially given the damage that he's sustained, but his language seems to me to be entirely his own. Where did you find his language?
All the years I was in Philadelphia, I was in a gym, and a boxing gym. Plural's own language is kind of an invention, probably, but the things that he sparks on, a lot of those are things that, you know, I heard old fighters talking about.
Sometime it just happened, says Plural.
when things get out of control.
And when he gets out of control.
Yeah.
Nothing surprises him, including the things he does himself, although he doesn't know he's going to do them, probably.
One of the subplots of the novel involves the disastrously unsuccessful but in part very funny attempt to create an interracial golf community. Were you trying to say something about America in 1953 with that tale, or does this tale still apply?
Well, it still applies. I mean, it's a different... I mean, but as long as there's been the racial problem, there have been people trying to make money off of it. It's as old as the country. It's just something that's been going on forever, I think.
It does seem particularly poignant that in the attempt to create this golf course and, as you say, get rich in the process, the very ground catches on fire when they try to get rid of a tree stump.
Yeah, I have to admit I liked that when that came to me. I mean, because it's one of those things where you hit on it and then you realize that it, what you just stumbled on is, you know, is better than you are. I mean, it's, if I'd been trying to think of that, I never could have. But, you know, you get out of the way and let it happen, right. And all of a sudden, the ground's on fire and it won't go out, you know, because that kind of a fire can't be put out.
So you got to get out of the way and let that happen, too, when an idea that good strikes you.
Well, I think the way that an idea like that comes to you is you've gotten out of the way. I don't mean that, you know, when I'm sitting at a typewriter, I'm not thinking about the words or anything, but there has to be a certain looseness, for me anyway, to have something like that pop into my head. Yeah, it sometimes happens when you're just talking. You have a couple of drinks and you're talking to somebody and suddenly you say something that everybody's laughing about and you realize you see why it's funny after they do, but you said it.
You worked as a sports writer before you began writing novels, and I wonder if, as you wrote sports stories, you felt yourself discovering characters and plots that would work later on in novels.
I was only a sports writer, not to correct you here, but I was only a sports writer for a year. I wrote the sports column for Esquire magazine, but I was essentially just a general interest columnist in Philadelphia all those years, the Philadelphia Daily News. And once in a while, I obviously spent a lot of time writing about boxing, but I never wrote about, you know, things I know a little bit about. I never tried to write about them in a sports way. I tried to always, open this up so that somebody who wasn't interested in boxing would be interested in what I had to say about this particular boxer or this thing. And so, yeah, I never particularly ran into stories that I used like that later, with the exception maybe of the first novel I ever wrote, where a guy rides around with his son-in-law's body in his truck for a couple, 3 days because, you know, he blew the money that the neighborhood collected to bury the kid, and he was afraid it was going to happen. I mean, that was a true story in Philadelphia, but it's more of you've been around enough stories so you begin to know how things really work, and then when a story comes to you, you apply what you know so that it sounds real.
Are you concerned at all that some critics and some readers won't take this novel as seriously as they might take a story that wasn't, at least in part, set in a sport, or in this case, in two sports?
I can't be concerned about it. I've noticed it. It's easy to classify. When I do this, it's easy to, I write like this, and somebody will say, well, it's a story about golf and about, you know, it's a L.A. Noir, if that's how you say that word, N-O-I-R. But I don't have any sense that it belongs in any of the classifications that it's been put in. You know, it's asking a lot for serious critics to take it seriously, although, I mean, I'm not going to argue with any of these people, but I would say that if they look at the language in this thing and then look at the language in the books that they want to review, that I think it hangs, you know, it'll hang in there. But, you know, thank God I didn't say it, because that would really sound immodest.
Pete Dexter is the author of 6 novels, the most recent of which is Train, published by Doubleday. Pete, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Listen, thanks for asking me.
You're listening to Only a Game. A lot of the recent letters have referred to Only a Game's mistakes, all of them mine. Karen Fine of Del Mar, New York, was listening closely enough to last week's program to hear me say that Pete Rose had blamed attention deficit hypertension disorder for his behavior, whereas in fact Rose cited attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So far as we know, the Hit King's blood pressure is okay. Elsewhere in the program, I referred to a Bosnian priest who lifts weights and said Cossack when I meant cassock. Jill Coelho, a WBUR listener, pointed out that any weightlifter, whether a man of the cloth or not, who rolls up the sleeves of a Cossack, quote, must be someone to reckon with. In the introduction to our story about cricket last week, I identified Lauderhill, Florida, as in Miami's neighborhood. Several Florida listeners, among them Marshall Ward and Adolfo Jimenez, wrote to correct my geography and to point out that Lauderhill is in Broward County, part of Greater Fort Lauderdale. Beyond all that, as Tom Halchuk called to point out, I botched the end of my interview with R.A. Dyer.
He didn't mention the book that he wrote when he was signing off. And I thought that was tragic,
so
now I'm going to have to go try to find it.
R.A. Dyer's book is Hustler Days, and it is published by the Lions Press. In another vein, another WBUR listener, Dave Perko, wrote, quote, your bias against NFL football detracts from Only a Game. Your show this morning spent less than 90 seconds on the playoffs, and that only in your conversation with Charlie Pierce. You certainly wouldn't slight the baseball playoffs this way. On a more positive note, Lori Williams of Boca Raton, Florida, wrote, did I just hear a show without hockey or soccer? Thanks! So, I guess you can't displease all of the people all of the time. Nancy Zui of Malden, Massachusetts, emailed to say, quote, not interested in sports, but your show is great. It helps me to make intelligent conversation with sports fans and relatives. I guess that's okay as long as the conversation doesn't turn to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, hypertension, Russian warriors, or the clothes worn by priests. Your corrections, comments, etc. will reach us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can also contact us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Waveland Avenue.
Reverse the curse, Riley!
The Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. The Bulls win!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports. And maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NBA action, the New York Knicks, under new head coach Lenny Wilkins, defeated Seattle 108-88. Dallas downed Denver 91-88. Miami singed the Clippers 87-85. Indiana beat San Antonio 89-79. Detroit dumped Washington 98-77. Phoenix foiled Golden State 104-93. Sacramento stymied the Lakers 103-83. And the Orlando Magic vanquished the Boston Celtics 124-118 in overtime. For Only a Game, I'm Bob See in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the straight dope on Jump Rope hip-hop style. But first, this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
You were very dope when you said that.
Whatever that means, I'll accept it as a compliment. Tomorrow in Foxborough, the offensive juggernaut that is the Indianapolis Colts will face the defensively abled New England Patriots. Will this mark the first time in history that the philosophical conundrum regarding unstoppable force and immovable object is played out in the physical universe?
No, because in the football universe, the good defense always squashes the good offense, especially on what will actually be a frozen tundra in New England this weekend. Although, apparently, the temperature is going to be a balmy 30 degrees at game time. It's shirt sleeve weather here in Foxborough.
It won't be as frozen as last weekend. So, Pats, Eagles in the Super Bowl, or Eagles, Colts, or Colts, Panthers, or Panthers, Pats, that's it for possibility.
I think it's going to be the New England Patriots and the upstart Carolina Panthers, because I don't think Philadelphia played that well last week. They benefited from a number of mistakes by Green Bay. They can be run upon if Steven Davis, the Carolina Panthers running back, is healthy. He will have a big day, and they are legitimately the hottest team in the NFL right now, even more than the Indianapolis Colts. I think the Patriots and the Panthers will play, and I think we'll all spit all over each other for 2 weeks while we talk about the game.
Foiled on the road to the Super Bowl this week were advocacy groups Move On and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, whose ads will apparently not run on CBS during its Super Bowl broadcast because the network says it does not run advertisements on, quote, controversial issues of public importance. Is that strictly accurate?
Well, I don't know. Why don't they just buy the CBS executives a bunch of really nice chicken suits and be done with it? This is the network that bailed on the miniseries about the Reagans. We all remember a couple of years ago that another network ran those absolutely stupid anti-drug spots all through the Super Bowl, which were a topic of some hilarity by the third quarter. The MoveOn.org ad is a splendid political advertisement. I hope everybody in America sees it. The PETA ads I haven't seen yet, but generally they're reasonably funny. But you know what? This is about CBS caving to advertisers and the government that those advertisers purchase, and I'm very disappointed.
We may soon have the basketball version of the old Dodgers-Yankees baseball rivalry because the New Jersey Nets are about to become the Brooklyn Nets, they tell me. Good for the Nets, good for the Knicks, good for the NBA?
We'll see. Those of us who grew up inundated by baseball nostalgia, even those of us who enjoyed it, like yourself, you know, have heard all about what a great sports town Brooklyn was. This would be an interesting experiment because there are very few undeveloped, unsportsed urban areas in America. And
unsportsed.
Brooklyn's one of them.
Unsportsed. I like that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Words are my tools.
Apparently, the controversy regarding same-sex marriage spilled over into the NBA recently. What is that all about?
Well, the Phoenix Suns were going to have church night now all together. Isn't that special? And they hooked up with something called the Center for Arizona Policy, which handed out invitation packages which referred to, quote, the enemy's assault on marriage! So a bunch of people complain, and the Suns dropped the center as a sponsor. People can say what I said about MoveOn.org, that the Suns chickened out. The center president is proclaiming on a website that homosexuals have hijacked church night. Well, isn't that special?
2/5 of the New York Yankees starting pitching staff will be pitching for Houston in the spring. Andy Pettit and Roger Clemens are Astros. Regarding Clemens, I gather that you are among the many unsurprised.
No, I have a philosophical conundrum for you, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
If a guy finishes a season or retires and then signs a contract to pitch before he ever missed a game, has he really retired?
No.
I don't think so either.
No.
I think it's incorrect grammatically and incorrect epistemologically to say that Roger Clemens ever retired just because he said he did.
Pete Rose's book, the one in which he confesses that he's been lying for 14 years, hit the top of the bestseller list this week. I'm not surprised by that, but I'm still not going to buy it. You?
Well, the problem I have with this whole thing is that the executive editor of sports books for this Rodale Publishing that published Pete Rose's book And I said, this is gratifying not so much that it's been a commercial success. Yeah, right. But because of the way, quote, I've seen Pete being re-embraced by the public. Have you seen Pete being re-embraced by the public? I certainly haven't.
Not the part of the public that's already in the Hall of Fame.
No.
They seem to be exceedingly dismayed.
Ferguson Jenkins.
And Henry Aaron.
And Henry Aaron have decided that they've changed their mind.
Exactly. Apparently, the world could have had the Pete Rose scoop about a year ago had a group of high school journalism students in Calabasas, California, acted like real journalists after Rose allegedly admitted to the class that he had bet on baseball games. Or is that an unfair interpretation?
No, they videotaped it, and he answered the question, you mean, why did I bet on baseball? Well, it was because I made mistakes. Now, these guys have managed to let this thing cover up, so I think every kid in this class has a future covering the White House.
Meanwhile, a Rose of another first name, Mitchell Rose, told the Daily News on Monday that Top Rank, Bob Arum's boxing promotion organization, had offered him money to throw a fight back in 1995. Top Rank's offices in Las Vegas were raided just before Mr. Rose made his accusations. Is it time to haul out that marvelous line from Casablanca?
Are you shocked? Shocked to learn that there might be some corruption. This is a serious thing. When the FBI takes your computers and your financial records, they don't take them and then give them back and say, what a surprise, Mr. Arum. We have discovered nothing you have done wrong in any of these records or on your computers. Bob Arum, who for years was the clean alternative, did you hear the quotation marks around that?
Mm-hmm.
This being radio. Clean alternative to Don King, has got a real problem on his hands.
Just after Andre Agassi strenuously defended tennis as a clean sport, John McEnroe acknowledged that he'd been on steroids for 6 years while he was playing, although he says he didn't know it at the time. Help, help me out with this one.
First of all, I watched a replay of the glorious Wimbledon final from 1980 between John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that looking at John McEnroe's physique, he's the worst advertisement for steroids I've ever seen. Second of all, was this guy an East German swimmer or what? I mean, he says for 6 years he was unaware he was being given a form of steroid of the legal kind they used to give horses until they decided it was too strong even for horses. What is this man talking about? What, he's never asked a question why his cornflakes tasted funny or why, you know, his morning banana and yogurt had sprouted a beard?
David Albury, a NASCAR fan who lives in Florida, noticed recently that his cat's fur was shaped like a number 3. Mr. Albury immediately thought Dale Earnhardt. So, when will other fans begin their pilgrimage to Mr. Albury's home?
I'm sorry, but I know this is probably sacrilegious, but doesn't this impress you as being one of those things like somebody sees, you know, the face of Jesus in a tortilla chip or something?
I just want to know if the
but
number 3
my,
was God weeping.
God love David Albury. His first reaction was to turn to his wife and say, Valerie, we're rich!
This week, FIFA President Sepp Blatter revealed his plan for popularizing women's soccer, and apparently it did not go over too well with the female footballers. What do you think of Mr. Blatter's proposal?
I think your favorite sport at its highest level is proudly marching into the 1950s. Sepp Blatter decided that women should wear skimpier kit, as they say in England,
mm-hmm.
for example, feminine clothes like they do in volleyball, for example. Ooh, hot pants! Huh, take it to the bridge! Take Sepp to the bridge, as a matter of fact.
Finally, Charlie, Frometown Football Club, which plays, believe it or not, in England's Screwfix Direct Premier Division,
yeah, right.
has only scored 3 goals at home this season, and so it has called in a self-proclaimed witch to deal with the goal drought. Assuming she's successful, I wonder which teams over here will try to engage Ms. Hardy's services.
Well, witches have already failed with the Red Sox several times, so
many
we can pass them along to the Cubs, maybe. But I was just wondering that if you take money to adjust the outcome of your game in the Screwfix League. Is that a Screwfix fix? Maybe I should ask Mitchell Rose.
Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, casts his spell over Only a Game listeners each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. But you are alive until you meet the witch. Breathing but not alive until you meet the witch. Witch. The witch.
The annual holiday Double Dutch Jump Roping Competition took place at Harlem's famed Apollo Theater last month. Reporter John Kalish was there, and he prepared this report on an urban pastime that has recently been transformed by hip-hop music.
Standing by, sophisticated ladies, slam and jam and jumpers, and Stan's Junior Pepper Steppers. Standing by.
Stan's Pepper Steppers are coached by Stanley Brown, who's been in Double Dutch for three decades. He considers it more than just a girls' playground game.
This is one of the few sports that you rely on the other person. You become like a family.
Stanley Brown coaches six teams, and one of them, the senior Pepper Steppers, has a 15-year-old standout.
My high school doubles team is headed by LaQuasha Brown. That little baby could jump.
Ready your ropes. Take your mark. Get set.
As the two-minute doubles event begins, an official with a manual counter presses a button each time the jumper's left feet touch the ground. When the event ends, LaQuasha Brown and her teammate had set a new indoor record for the double speed competition.
We had 421 jumps in 2 minutes. We all worked together. We broke the record.
Once the exclusive province of girls, Double Dutch now attracts a small number of boys. Jason Pizarro is a 10th grader with the Pepper Steppers. He competes in the single speed event.
I like competing athletically, and this is the way I know how to do it. I'm not really good in other sports, so I do this.
Is this hard for a boy to do this sport? Do kids back in your neighborhood give you a hard time about it?
If I like doing it, I'm going to do it. I'm not going to let anybody else tell me that I can't do it. It makes me an individual, not listening to what everybody else says.
Double Dutch was brought to New York by Dutch colonists centuries ago. It enjoyed a resurgence during World War II, but died out in the 1950s. In the 1970s, an African-American police officer reintroduced it to New York City schoolgirls.
I'm going to be like the Don King of Double Dutch.
David Walker is the man who almost single-handedly sparked a Double Dutch revival in 1974, beginning with its introduction at a Harlem middle school. Walker estimates that 40,000 jumpers are now involved in Double Dutch around the country. There are Double Dutch clubs in France, Germany, Austria, and Sweden. What had been an outdoor game is now done indoors, and those accompanying sing-song rhymes are gone. But Double Dutch rope turners can be offering words of encouragement to jumpers in the double speed competition, occasionally reminding them to move closer or further from the center of the ropes.
What happens is they bark at each other. The turners are the ones who are communicating with the jumper. And the jumper is basically focusing on what he or she has to do. You're listening to the sound of the ropes, and you're listening to the bark of the turner. And sometime the jumper will bark out an expression also.
Twelve years ago, Walker created what has become the most popular form of Double Dutch competition, the Fusion event. It is equal parts jumping, choreography, and gymnastics, mostly done to a hip-hop beat. David Walker got the idea at a dance competition in France.
I did a performance presentation at Montpellier Dance Festival in 1991 in front of a lot of dance professors. And at the end of the five-day stay, they came with me, they gave me an evaluation. They said, David, Double Dutch will not go anywhere unless you can introduce music to the accompaniment of the, what they call a freestyle performance. And from that point on, I said, I'm going to try to make it work.
David Walker brought Double Dutch to Japan in 1996, and it caught on quickly. The Japanese have won the best of show competition at the annual Double Dutch Holiday Classic every year they've competed since 1996. This year was no exception. When judges pick the team that is best in show, one of the factors in their decision is the reaction of the other teams who sit in the audience and cheer on their opponents. According to Jim Green, a publicist for the Double Dutch Holiday Classic.
The decision is based upon the people in the audience, the teams that they defeated. You will find those teams standing up and clapping the loudest for them because those teams understand how difficult what they did is to do.
The Fusion teams do splits, cartwheels, somersaults, midair flips, wheelbarrow walking, and breakdancing. They typically have six members, and rope turners will sometimes pass the rope to a teammate while someone is in the middle of a jump. There are two ropes going at the same time, but they are not always turning parallel to each other. Cita Wise has been jumping for 13 of his 25 years. He's a member of the Double Dutch Forces from Columbia, South Carolina. The team donned T-shirts with airbrushed graffiti designs and what looked like pajama bottoms for its debut at the Apollo Theater.
Everybody has their own type of music that they can jump to, and music is capturing everybody and making everybody want to become a part of Double Dutch.
How do the old-timers feel about the new direction Double Dutch has taken? Andrea Cherry was a Double Dutch champion in 1977. She now works as a corrections officer in New York City and officiates at Double Dutch competitions.
The things that they're doing now is totally astronomical. They're flipping all over the place. You practically have to be a gymnast at this point to really be in, you know, solid competition.
Do you like the direction it's been going in?
Yeah, I like it. I like the music. It takes away from the monotony of just sitting there watching a person jump. And, you know, hearing the music, you know, gets the audience more involved because Double Dutch is a spectator sport.
Organizers of the Double Dutch Holiday Competition bemoan the lack of corporate support, which was plentiful in decades past, but has vanished in recent years. Still, they have great hopes for the sport, which they say is worthy of becoming an Olympic event someday. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Doug Patterson at KUOW in Seattle and from Shai Ben-Yakov of member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter, or perhaps learn more about Pete Dexter's train, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from writer and Philadelphia Eagles fan Joe Queenan, who observes that there's at least one major difference between those who play our games and those who write about them.
Athletes are physical, and writers are verbal. Unless they're Terry Bradshaw, who never shuts up.
Well, yeah, and then there's Norman Mailer, who was always punching people. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Skip-a-roo. Skip-a-roo. Just listen to the children while they play. Really not funny what the children say. Skip a rope. 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 Skip a rope.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.